Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, your guide to better cricket, half an hour or somewhere around that region, where we help you, or we help you to help others improve their game. My name is David Hinchliff. I look after things, and helping me to help you are two very fine cricket coaches, the first of which is the director of cricket at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garris. How's it going?
Yeah, good, thank you. It's a bit damp, isn't it? A bit grizzly, but no, it's
beautiful
been
here,
it's been
as always.
Yeah, it's been okay. I've watched quite a lot of cricket in the rain recently, which puts a different different slant on it. I've become a fan of these like little tents that the parents put up and sit under. They're like sort of
good
spectator like shelters. And so I'm in the market. I'm in the market for one, definitely.
Bring your own hospitality box.
It's quality, isn't it? I was very impressed with that when I watched some cricket this week.
Some Prosecco in the cool box and away you go.
Yeah, that's next week. We've got Vaughan down next week. So the whole Vaughan clan are coming, then that is very much Prosecco week.
Oh, there you go. Exactly. Living in the glamorous lifestyle. Yeah, we haven't had any cricket here for quite a long time. 12 overs in the last 3 weeks. And it's quite annoying. But yeah, it's nice weather today, so hopefully we'll get some cricket in soon enough. While we were not playing cricket for 3 weeks in a row, one of our student players went home to Kent and managed to sneak in 10 games in 3 weeks. So he's done pretty well there.
Well done. Great effort.
Yeah, well done to you, sir. Second, who I've been ignoring so far, but we'll bring him into the conversation now. It's the head of cricket performance at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery, back from your travels, Lavers.
Yeah, back last night. Lovely 2.5 weeks of exploring a few new places, going and revisiting a few old ones, and watching a bit of sport, and watching a bit of cricket on the TV as well in the evenings, which times quite nicely. It seems to be that when we were out in Australia, the cricket would kick off at 8 o'clock out there, so we'd watch the test match from out there and over dinner, and it would be a really nice experience. But fabulous for all the kids to get a bit of time in Hong Kong and travelling around Australia, playing some sport, meeting some great schools and playing against some good kids.
And did you pick anything up from your travels in terms of the way things are done in other sports or in other countries compared to the way that you've done things in the past?
One of the things that did come up, and it's not necessarily something that I'm directly involved in, but it was good to see that from a rugby point of view, well, our head of rugby was obviously leading the rugby section of the tour, and we were playing at one of the big schools in Sydney, and the school rugby competition in Sydney is renowned as probably the strongest in the world. And there are eight teams or six teams in that kind of top league there, and they're regarded as being as good as anyone. But from what it looks like, the processes and the system and the fitness work and everything like that is actually pretty similar to what we do. It's just the way that the recruitment's done that's a little bit different, that allows them to do what they do, and also a little bit of extra time availability, things like that. But generally, on the whole, I think our head of rugby was pretty pleased that that what we're doing is very much mirroring that of the best of our kind of age range, and hopefully we're looking for a few things that we can do that maybe they don't do.
Yeah, it's always great to look in on other sports and see what you can find out there, even if you don't necessarily find anything that works directly. It's great to sort of have a look and think, I wonder if there are any applications here. Just gets the old mind ticking over, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the other thing that was great was to see some of our guys who are good or strong cricket players out of their cricket environment. I spend all my time with them, seeing them play cricket, and a good chunk of those senior cricketers are also pretty adept senior hockey players or rugby players. So seeing them in that different environment, seeing how they behave, seeing how they prepare, and seeing how they fit into a completely different group was really interesting. So really enjoyable experience, and I hope, and I'm pretty sure that all the kids enjoyed it just as much, if not more, and got a load out of it, which would be our initial intention in the first place.
Let's get some readers' questions answered now, listeners' questions. I say readers because questions, the way this works is that questions are sent in by people who listen to the show, of course, but also by people who read the Pitch Vision website at pitchvision.com. We don't discriminate here. However you want to get a question to us, we'll do our best to answer it. And then the best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And if you want to send a question in to us for future shows, you can do that by emailing coach@pitchvision.com, or you can get in touch with us using social media, which we'll tell you about towards the end of the show. First person who's got in touch with us this week is Ben. And Ben says, how important is it to have a bent front leg when defending the ball?
Yeah, ideally, you want to have that, and for a number of reasons. It helps you to get a closer distance, particularly against seam, I would say, between your back contact and your body weight and your centre of gravity. So by doing that, having that centre of gravity nice and close, you've got your head nice and close. So you're not on the stretch, really, with your hands, because when we stretch on the hands, that's when we push it hard. And it's been interesting to watch this series between England and South Africa, where the ball has done a little bit. And it's been commented on regularly by the Sky team and also by the Test Match Special team, which includes people like Michael Vaughan, Graham Swan, Graham Smith in this series, Ed Smith, who have all picked up on the fact that there are a number of players who push forward with hard hands, and that often comes from having a straight front leg when you're defending. So Keaton Jennings being a classic example in the last couple of weeks, versus somebody like Joe Root, who plays forward and bends his front knee a little bit more regularly and as a result has softer hands. The best example in world cricket presently is probably Kane Williamson, who does that fantastically well. So bending into the ball takes his body weight close to the ball, takes his head close to the weight of the ball, but also you have that sort of bent arms position as opposed to a straight arms position, which is often associated with soft hands. So I think it's really important, particularly against seam, yeah.
I think what I've heard a lot of commentators say is that it's sort of an offhand comment about blaming bowling machines and how, you know, because you're getting a reliable feed and you are, you know, you're able to hit the ball on the up because, you know, often with the bowling machine, you're indoors and, you know, you're getting flat wickets and a predictable delivery that you can play your drives with confidence and not have to worry too much about getting your weight forward too much or playing the ball later. You can play the ball earlier and still get away with playing a booming drive. Do you think, Lavers, that maybe there's something in that, you know, if the type of practice that you have can affect the way that you play if you're not careful?
Oh yeah, I'm sure it can do, and ultimately we want to be rounded cricketers and we want to have a wide range of skills, and to achieve that we do need an amount of variability in our practice, and we do need to look at approaching the same type of shot in different ways, and there's definitely a place for that high volume, high repetition practice, which is going to be really useful in technical development for a lot of people. And I think everyone has their own opinion on what works for them, but I think for most people there's going to be an element of that is going to be helpful, whereas ultimately at some stage that's going to have to transfer out onto a pitch where not every ball is in the same place and not every ball is going to come exactly the same speed or have exactly the same trajectory through the air. And so then progressing onto that varied environment is something that you need to do. It is odd that the bowling machine does take the criticism, because I think it's more the surface that is actually the result. You put a bowling machine on a grass surface and people won't play that way. Because there's an amount of variability. So the bowling machine does get a bit of stick when it's not really responsible. It's the indoor floor that's the main reason for it, because get someone bowling a length ball and they get punched back down the ground, don't they? Get a spinner bowling indoors and it's, even if it is turning a bit because the speed's so consistent, someone gets down there and puts their hands through it, and it is the surface more than the machine in my opinion. And the machine's extremely valuable and we use them a lot in our development throughout the year and particularly so in the early stages of the winter. But again, it's a good opportunity for people to simply hit balls at other times of the year as well. I would definitely be using it in your program, but be aware that there's a variability that we need, and we need to have that varied surface so that those instinctive or subconscious reactions can take place to things that happen that are just so late in the day we can't consciously adapt to them. But if we expose ourselves to them, our body seems to do things for us occasionally, which I wish mine had done a bit more often back in the day.
Yeah, if you let yourself, you know, if you let your brain and body solve problems for you, that's often a lot easier than trying to work it out for yourself and just getting in your own way almost. It's funny to say that, isn't it? But we have sort of got two brains, haven't we? The brain that can do all the good stuff if you let it, and the brain that just gets in the way because it doesn't like to lose control.
Yeah, you've got that one that you control. You've got the one where you've got the joystick and you can make things move and you can make things happen. And there's the other bit that says, I'm going to do what I want to do. And sometimes it works for you and sometimes it can work against you. But you need to train it. You need to expose it to different things and you need to hopefully develop into a stage where you can trust it.
We have indoor nets with a concrete surface, so we do have a little shorthand thing that has developed since I've been at the club, which is, you know, oh, that was a net shot, you know, and it's come from the players, you know, someone's batting and they'll hit a booming drive on the up, you know, against a bowler who's, you know, bowling a relatively slow pace and not moving the ball around much, and they hit it on the up, and then they, you know, immediately, especially if it's a decent batsman, he'll just say to us, oh, that was a net drive, wasn't it? And you sort of, yes, it was, yeah. So remember that just because you can play a really nice shot out the middle of the bat in the nets doesn't mean you're going to do the same thing, you know, on a wet one in North Glasgow.
Yeah, good luck with that. Just on that front leg stuff as well, I think it's another... We talked about having straight front leg in the past, haven't we, for generating power, and it's something that's going to increase the power output. So if you bend the front leg, it's working the opposite way, and having that ability to absorb the pace of the ball and absorb the energy that the ball is creating as it travels and hits the bat, so that you can keep the ball close to you and drop it towards point, and it just rolls 3 or 4 steps rather than 10 or 15 steps, and you scamper that single because he's got to run in 20 yards, is a really valuable way of defending. And sometimes you want to defend and you want to keep the ball as close to you rather than trying to whack the ball 80 yards, 90 yards out of the ground. So it's another method. Well, that joint there is another thing that's going to absorb a bit of that energy and keep the ball nice and tight to you so you can get down the other end.
So what we're saying is it helps.
Yeah, it definitely does. That is for sure.
And front leg helps. Yeah. But I always think it's a bit of a... You don't want to necessarily work on it specifically. It's almost like, well, if you're doing it right, you know, if you feel like everything's going right, then it happens, you know, and it's sort of an indicator of success rather than something that you want to actively work towards, right? You sort of, if you do the right kind of training against the right kind of bowling and the right kind of thing, that's something that happens.
Exactly right. It doesn't, you know, you don't necessarily need it to be a focus, but if it's something, I mean, if I was working with a Keaton Jennings at the moment, I might want to make it a focus because it's going to be increasingly difficult for him to play the moving ball unless he can get more of his body weight going back into it, or his judgment has got to be unbelievably finite, and obviously if you can take that increase your margin for error, then that helps you out as a player. And that's what we see in somebody like an Alistair Cook, and that's what we see in somebody like a Joe Root, which enables them to be successful on a more consistent basis. So most times I'd say, well, just, you know, be aware of it, let it happen. But some stages you do have to work at it, and it becomes a technical deficiency. So never steer away from that if it's required.
We've had a little preview of the next question almost, because it's to do with bowling machines. So we'll get straight into the question, because I know, Gareth, that a while ago you wrote a article about bowling machines and how they're like Marmite, which I don't know if everyone in the world has heard of Marmite, but it's a foodstuff that has divides opinion. But we'll get to that in a second. A question from Nick, and Nick says, my club struggles with quality bowlers at training. Do you think you can make progression with a bowling machine and good throwdowns?
Yes, you can, definitely. I think it's really important to know when you're working with bowling machines what you're working on and what you're actually trying to train. So obviously the most common practice is grooving, and that's building up your neural pathways, your muscle memory, for want of a more layman's term, to be able to fall into place and hit repeated balls. But, you know, we also know that bowling machine balls get old and they start to react in different ways, which then brings in that amount of variability without the user having to do anything as well, which is obviously good because you have to wait for the ball, see it, and then move appropriately. So they can be really good. But there's a number of good practices that you can do with a bowling machine which are very specific, and a couple of them I've stolen from Matthew Maynard, the Somerset coach and the ex-England batting coach, who uses them at very slow paces. So he puts them on at 60 miles an hour or 55 miles an hour, because often one of the challenges that batters face is waiting for the ball, isn't it? I mean, how many times do we talk to players and how many times do we see players reaching for the ball, not letting it finish its journey towards the batsman? So he puts it on at slow paces and really building up that discipline of waiting for the ball. He rarely works in that nice zone of 65 to 75 mile an hour, which most batters, if they want to just hit some balls, will tend to put the bowling machine on at that pace because it's pretty comfortable. So he'd operate at the lower range and he'd operate at the higher range. And obviously when you're operating at the higher range, you're bringing in reactions because the time that you've got to be able to play the ball is so much less. So I think there are two fantastic methods of using the bowling machines. One, to let the ball come onto you to get into the habit of waiting for that ball, and secondly to really get your reactions going. And when you do your reaction stuff, get the ball away from the batter to start off with, so they can almost stand there and just let these balls go past, even if it's on 90 miles an hour. Because I can tell you now that the first ball that goes past you at 90 miles an hour, way outside off stump, is going to feel quite threatening. And by the time you get to your 100th ball of it going outside the line of your body, it's going to become more comfortable because you're going to become exposed and accustomed to it. And then at some stage, just say to the batter, whenever you're ready, try and play a shot at it. Try and hit the ball. And it's amazing how quickly people are able to play shots against that in a fairly convincing fashion, even though the velocity of the ball is much more than they've been previously exposed to. But, you know, we've got to be safe with them. But the biggest downside to bowling machines presently, and this is where something is beginning to happen on this, is the fact that we don't use cricket balls. I mean, one of the most unique things about our sport is that seam, that bit of string that goes around the ball, which makes it deviate off the pitch, whether it be a spin bowler trying to orientate that seam against the pitch to get the ball to break off the wicket, or whether it be a fast bowler who's trying to get that seam to go down the wicket so it hits the pitch at a canter and deviates in another way. And that's the biggest challenge with conventional bowling machines for me, is that the fact that the latest movement is the most dangerous one, and that's often seam movement, and we don't get to simulate that. But now there is a bowling machine that's coming out called CricAttack, which uses cricket balls and also gives you a full vision of the ball coming down the tube, so it helps people to get into those rhythms and timings which a lot of people struggle with when they're playing against bowling machines. And you can get the ball to swing in conventional fashions because you're using cricket balls, and you can get the ball to seam, so it's much more realistic, particularly when playing against pace. So that's an exciting thing. I'd keep an eye out for that, and then all of a sudden you're simulating a cricket ball hitting the bat, a cricket ball hitting the pitch, which is as close as you're going to get to the real thing. So they can be useful. But going back to your question, bit of bowling machine, yes, some throwdowns. I'd really encourage people to have a look at the sidearm. You know, we have a scheme at school where people are allowed to practice into an open net with no batter with a sidearm, and when they're able to hit a length, bowl a bouncer and hit a Yorker in three consecutive balls times two to make an over, then they are signed off and ready to be able to bowl and throw at their mate using a sidearm. And they are fantastic practice because we get the opportunity to read the visual cues of the thrower or the bowler that's using them. And often the accuracy is so much better because we're not having to hoof the ball down the other end. We can just ease the ball down the other end. And the extension of the sidearm gives you that range of motion which pulls the ball through at a rapid rate of knots for seamers. So it's a fantastic thing. It's not just for coaches. I would encourage, if you've got a birthday coming up for one for your your son or your daughter that's playing cricket and they're keen to develop their game, get them a sidearm, get them and their mates to learn to use it properly in a safe way, and then they can practice to their heart's content where you're picking up those cues and you're using a cricket ball and it can be fantastic practice. So there's my three methods.
And when it comes to throwdowns, Lavers, putting the sidearm aside, which I can only echo what Gareth says there, the sidearm is such a useful tool. But if you are only getting throwdowns, what's some good sort of advice that you can give to someone who's either giving throwdowns or getting throwdowns that will help them get the most out of it?
Well, again, they're going to allow someone to judge that line and length and speed of delivery, so that there is real value in it. And they're also going to see a ball coming out of a hand. And yes, it's a bent arm, but it's still seeing a ball coming out of a hand, and it allows them to get that timing and synchronisation of their movements with that of the bowler or in this case, thrower. I guess it depends on what you're wanting to work on, and we need to consider the pace of the throw. So depending on who you've got, you might want to adjust that length of the pitch. And a lot of the time when we do throwdowns, we'll probably do it from about 15 or 16 yards with a two or three step run up and try and drive it down with a bit of pace there. But similarly, throwdowns can still be bowling spin and throwing off spin, things like that, which are really, really valuable, and it allows people to generally change that angle of delivery or that sort of angle of rotation of the ball a little bit more with a little bit of skill. A bit like with the sidearm, if you can learn a little bit of skill in throwing some spin, then you can become a really valuable person to have in training, because you can throw an arm ball, you can throw an off spinner, and you can probably throw a top spinner, and you might even be able to do that a little bit extra and get it going the other way a little bit as well. So having that skill as a thrower is really important to the group, or can be really valuable to the group. And obviously as a batter, having someone who can work with you like that is a big advantage. I think that recently we started to, I'm trying to think when we did this now, it's probably a year or so ago, we started to start a lot of sessions with 5 or 10 minutes of throwdowns, and it's just rotating through a little cycle of different shots. And finish with a little bit of variability, and it just gets everyone moving. It's a good little warm-up activity. Everyone gets to hit some balls, so the bowlers are also in there getting some batting done as well. Probably takes 10 or 15 minutes, but when you get into those sessions when you're kind of halfway, two-thirds through the season, and the sessions become seemingly that little bit longer, it's a good way to chop 15, 20 minutes out at the start of the session and use something, do something pretty valuable. And again, as Gareth has mentioned previously, you're using a cricket ball, so there's that little bit of variation in there. You're probably going to be using a dozen different cricket balls as you're doing throwdowns, because you'll have a bag of balls with you, and being able to respond to each one and if possible try and learn how each one behaves is another really, really useful skill, and something that people overlook quite a lot is how to learn about what's going to happen and see if you can pick out what's going to happen from the hand before it actually does. And with a throwdown, you can be doing that. You can be looking for the bowler's grip. You can be looking for where the seam is in relation to their fingers and how it's like to come out, which obviously on a bowling machine, there aren't any cues for you to assess. So a throwdown does give you a bit of added value there.
And I suppose what we're saying is that the sort of overarching point is that the method is not as important as the way that you go about training, and the way that are you challenging yourself, and are you looking to develop something, and are you focused on something, rather than, as you said a little while back, Gareth, if you put the bowling machine at 65 mile an hour, say, can you give me out swinging half ollies, please, put it on one swing, and then you hit two buckets of those, and then you think, oh great, I'm a good nick, look, I hit most of them pretty well. That's not really, you're not really challenging yourself there, are you? But if you're challenging yourself, you're trying to focus on something, and then you're using the tools at your disposal to, in order to improve that thing, then you're going to get better. And then it's almost like the tool doesn't matter as much as the focus, right?
No, absolutely right. And it's about knowing what you're trying to get out of your practice. And if you can do that, whatever implement or whether it's bobble feeds. You know, one of the, going back to the original question, can you get better by doing throwdowns or whatever? Of course you can. You know, the starting point for Michael Vaughan every morning of his test match career was to have 20 bobble feeds before he got into facing some overarm throws, before he got into facing some batters. But it was very much a specific and built up program which got him into an ideal performance state, or as close to it as he possibly could be. So I have a real idea of what you're doing. It was interesting watching Brendan McCullum on a recent video talking about his practice methods, and he had some drills called contrast drills, which are really, you know, sharp back foot, front foot and pull drills, where he's challenging himself, where a feed is very, very close, only hitting tennis balls, but the ball's coming from a very short distance. And, you know, if he hits sort of 50% in the middle, then he's pretty happy. It starts to get the body moving, and then all of a sudden he can go to his more conventional sort of stuff. Every time I hear a top quality player talk about their drills, they're different drills, but the specificity and the focus that they have and the understanding of what they're trying to get out of each of a drill is there. And if us as amateur players or aspiring professional players can take on some of those things around specificity and focus, and being really aware of what you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it, then I think we'll all benefit from that.
Just going back to what you said about Matthew Maynard's drill, Gareth, there, and I'm not sure if this is how he does it or not, but as a drill we've used a few times now, which I really like, is when we have two lets side by side, and one set up on 55 and one set up on 75, and they actually do an over in each one, and they're not only having to cope with two situations, but they're having to adapt from one to the other as well. I'm not sure if that's how he's set it up previously, but that's something that we've done. And again, the slower ball is so much often the harder one, but then that 75 one, which people adapt to 75 or 80 or 85, they adapt in a reasonable period of time generally. But if you're always having that contrast of going back to the slower one and then back to the fast one, then there's constant challenge going on between the two, which is what we're trying to create, isn't it? Challenge to make people improve.
I mean, that's another great progression, that, Sam. Again, you've got real idea about why you're doing that drill, and that's really important. Another drill which I featured is the up and up drill, where you start at a fairly comfortable pace, and every time somebody hits two good shots or makes two good decisions consecutively, you put the speed up by 1 mile an hour, and then you stop the drill when you make an error or get bowled or get caught by setting your field. And it's something I do with one of our youngest players, you know, a 14-year-old called Jamie Baird, is somebody that I do this with regularly, and he works from 60 mile an hour all the way up to 90 mile an hour, and he's been doing that for the past 7 months, and being able to deal with that on a regular basis. He, you know, his batting's gone through the roof, but he's ready for that now. Even though he's only 14, he's ready for that. You know, and it's contributed alongside everything else that he does in his program and the way he goes about it. To, you know, he scored 1100s this year. He's just shy of 2000 runs, playing up three age groups, which is just absolutely remarkable. But it's the way that he goes about his practice, and he tells me what he wants rather than me telling him what he wants. And that's a great way to be at 14. I certainly wasn't like that. That is for sure.
Oh, if you can get young players who tell you what they want, and what they want is a challenge, and they're going to tell you something that's going to challenge them, that's fantastic. Because as David said previously, a lot of the time people will tell you what they want, and what they want is an easy ride for half an hour, isn't it? Rather than somebody who's going to come in and challenge them and make life tough, but give them something that's going to make them better. So when you got someone like that, it's a pleasure to work with.
And it, going back, you know, going away from the question, but it's part of the question as well, is Joe Root, when he had his first ever session with Kevin Sharp up at Yorkshire, when he was a kid, I think he might have been 11, 12 years old, something like that, he watched a session that Kevin Sharp did with Anthony McGrath, who was batting four for Yorkshire at the time, where they did a short ball session. And Joe Root was up on the balcony, and he's watching it headingly, and walks down, and Kevin Sharp said, "Oh, nice to meet you. My name's Kevin. I hear you've been going well in your age group stuff." And he said, "Oh, no, thanks very much." And Kevin said, "So what do you want to do today?" And most, you know, 11, 12-year-olds would probably look at you a bit blankly and go, "Well, I don't know, what do you want to do?" But he turned around and said, "I want to do exactly that session." And Sharpie was a bit taken back, you know, well, if I do that, I'm likely to kill you sort of thing, or I'm likely to... He said, no, I want exactly that, and I want you to go as hard at me. And Sharpie said he threw the first ball in, and he reckoned for 7/8 of a ball's journey, it is just a bouncer that's going straight towards this 11-year-old's batting helmet. And then he got out of the way of it and had this big smile on his face. And that, you know, that is what's fueled Joe's rapid rise and now sustained performance in Test match cricket. And it doesn't matter whether he's doing throwdowns, whether he's doing underarm drills, whether he's doing sidearm, or whether he's doing bowling machine. There's always a purpose to what he's doing. He knows why he's doing it. So all of these things can work. There's no right or wrong way about going about it. As long as you know why you're doing it and you have a good focus, you can't go too far wrong.
And that is just about all we've got time for on the show this week. We are going to head off, but before we do that, there's just one more thing that we need to sort out, and that's the winner of this week's competition. The online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com is up for grabs. And the two questions were Ben's question about a bent front leg and Nick's question about quality bowlers and making progress with a bowling machine and throwdowns. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
Well, I thought they were both brilliant questions. And Ben, you've been very unlucky here, mate, because Nick's question probably got the most thorough answer that we as a group have ever come up with. So purely because of our performance, as well as a brilliant question.
Well played us.
I thought we were outstanding this week, lads, on that one. So Nick's question wins. But Ben, you are very unlucky because your question was awesome as well, bud.
Yeah, credits. Credit where it's due, lads. We've done absolutely brilliant this week.
We were outstanding, lads.
Oh, God.
Massive slaps on the back for us all.
Okay, well, if anyone's still listening after that ridiculousness, Gareth,
they're all gone.
And they wanted to send in a question to us so we could be more self-congratulatory next week. How could they get in touch with the show?
They could give us a call on 0203-239-7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
Yes, indeed, you can do that. And you can also contact us in lots of other ways. Social media, of course, pitchvision.com is the way to go to message us through the Pitch Vision system. You can just get a free account there and do that. Find Pitch Vision Academy on there. If you want to get in touch with us through other social media, or on Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy, and Twitter @pitchvisionacad. If you want to listen to the show every week, you can do that by subscribing. That's free, and you can do that in any podcast app. Just do a search for Pitch Vision Academy in there. You'll find us. Tap or click on subscribe, and away you go. And if you want to get old show notes or download the old shows or have a look at streaming the shows, you can do all that kind of thing as well through the Pitch Vision website, pitchvision.com/academy, and click on the podcast link for all the details there. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavis.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks, guys.